Welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the channel with Carrie Figner. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. Today, my guest is Professor Max Deutsch. His new book is titled The Myth of the Intuitive, Experimental Philosophy and Philosophical Method. It has just been published by MIT Press. Deutsch is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Hong Kong. There's a movement in contemporary philosophy known as experimental philosophy, or XPhi for short. It proceeds against the backdrop of a critique of contemporary analytic philosophy. According to the XPhi critique, analytic philosophers rely too heavily on an unsound method. It's a method that involves arguing for philosophical conclusions from premises whose force is said to rest solely in what philosophers find to be intuitive or obvious. Using polling and survey methods, experimental philosophers endeavor to show that claims that philosophers often take to be intuitive are in fact not commonly held among non-philosophers, and that individuals' sense of what's obvious varies according to factors such as ethnicity, geography, age, and gender. In light of this, X-Files claim that analytic philosophy is doomed, for it treats philosophers' intuitions as evidence in favor of philosophical claims. But the variability of intuitions, they say, shows that these intuitions have no evidentiary weight. Now, in The Myth of the Intuitive, Max Deutsch defends analytic philosophy against the XPhi critique. He shows that, in fact, analytic philosophers do not treat intuitions as evidence. Drawing upon careful readings of the texts that are the central targets of the XPhi critique, Deutsch shows that analytic philosophers rarely appeal to intuitions as if these intuitions provided evidence for anything. The Myth of the Intuitive is a lively and rigorously argued book about a central debate among philosophers about methodology. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Max Deutsch.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Happy to be doing this interview.
Well, great. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. My guest is Max Deutsch, and we're going to be talking about his new book. It's titled The Myth of the Intuitive, Experimental Philosophy and Philosophical Method. The book is just published by MIT Press. I recommend the book highly to all philosophers, mainly because it's a book about philosophical method. And it proposes a powerful rejoinder to what is an increasingly popular and influential methodological movement in current academic philosophy. I'm talking about the movement of experimental philosophy, sometimes called XPhi. Now, a lot of XPhi, as listeners may know, draws its motivation from a kind of critical stance or critique of what are taken to be standing methods used in most contemporary analytic philosophy. But Max argues that experimental philosophy and its practitioners, which he calls X-Files, have misunderstood the methods of analytic philosophy and misunderstood these techniques that analytic philosophers commonly employ, and that consequently it might be the case, maybe this is too strong yet before we hear Max's arguments, but maybe it's the case, Max thinks, that experimental philosophy rests on a mistake. So there's a lot to discuss. But first, Max, let's start where we usually do, which is with the author telling us a little bit about himself.
Yeah, sure. So thanks again for conducting the interview, Bob. I'm very pleased to be doing this.
Sure.
So yeah, a little bit about me. Well, I was born in L.A., in Los Angeles, California, but I did a lot of my growing up in Seattle, Washington, and in the Midwest also, in a small college town called Bloomington Normal, Illinois, which is where I'm talking to you from right now. My father is also a philosopher. His name is Harry Deutsch, and he lives here in Bloomington Normal, and as do my in-laws. So coming to Bloomington kills two birds with one stone, I guess. Visit with my in-laws and hang out with my dad. As far as sort of academic background, I went to UC Berkeley and got an MA, but then I left Berkeley after about 3.5 years and went to Rutgers, and I got my PhD at Rutgers. And my advisor at Rutgers was Colin McGinn, who was a terrific advisor to me. And there I wrote a dissertation on the mind-body problem. And I argued in the dissertation that there can be mental facts or properties that are both subjective and physical, and that possibility, the possibility of subjective physical facts or properties, diffuses some of the most challenging anti-physicalist arguments out there. So, for example, the Mary argument, Frank Jackson's famous Mary argument.
Right. And I guess the Nagel stuff, too, must be a target.
And the Nagel stuff, too.
Yeah, good. Yeah.
And so I'm interested in many issues in the philosophy of mind and language. I've published in Philosophy of Mind and Philosophy of Language, and the concern with issues in metaphilosophy, philosophical methodology. That's relatively recent for me, although I say that when I think back now, I realize that I've been thinking about this stuff since about 2001, basically the advent of the experimental philosophy movement. Should I go on about myself, or should I describe how I came to write The Myth of the Intuitive? What would you?
Sure, that would be good. But also, you're teaching now in Hong Kong.
Ah, right. Yes. Yes, I'm teaching. I'm teaching it.
An interesting fact.
Yes,
right?
It's an interesting fact for you. Sure. Yes. Yes, I teach at Hong Kong University in Hong Kong, China, and it's. It's been good. I've been there since 2001, on and off, actually. I left HKU around 2006, and I took a job in North Carolina at East Carolina University, but I stayed there only a couple of years. And then I went back. Luckily, Hong Kong decided they would take me back after a hiatus of a couple of years. So I went back to Hong Kong U, and I've been there ever since about 2007. And I chair the department there now, and things have been pretty good in Hong Kong for me. I have to say, the job.
Do you like living in Hong Kong? I could just imagine. What do I know? But I could just imagine it was a real adjustment. Or am I wrong about that?
No, definitely, it was very much an adjustment. When I moved in 2001, of course, I thought, well, maybe not. Of course, that depends. I thought it would be a temporary gig. I thought, well, I'll take this job, and then I'll move on. I'll spend an interesting exotic year in Hong Kong, and then I'll be back, in the good old US of A. But things didn't really work out as planned, and we ended up staying for 4 years before we eventually left. And then, as I said, we eventually came back to Hong Kong. Living in Hong Kong is very interesting. So it's a archipelago, a series of islands, Hong Kong, and Hong Kong itself is the main island. But there are a bunch of outlying islands, and I live on one of the outlying islands called Lama Island. And Lama is great because there are no cars on Lama, so there's a lot of green space and lots of places for my kids. I have two daughters, lots of places for my kids to run around, and I commute to work by ferry. So I get on a boat every day, and I sail into the main island, and then get on a bus and head up to campus. And the city itself is just, it's a blooming, buzzing place, and it's fascinating culturally and these days also politically. It's been a good gig, Hong Kong.
Great. So you picked up this interest then in philosophical methodology.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I picked up this interest in philosophical methodology, around 2001 or maybe 2002. A colleague of mine at the time at HKU was Ron Malin. And Ron Malin is one of the authors of one of experimental philosophy's most famous documents a paper called Semantics Cross Cultural Style. And that's written by Edouard Machery, Ron Mallon, Sean Nichols, and Stephen Stitch. Stephen Stitch is really the granddaddy of
I was going to say godfather, but maybe that's not exactly right.
The godfather of X-Files Everywhere. So Steve is responsible for a lot of this a lot of this movement. But anyway, Ron is a student of Steve's, and Ron was there. He was a colleague of mine, and he was working on the vignettes that they gave to their experimental subjects. He was working on the vignettes, and this was a paper that has to do with the philosophy of language, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about its details later on. But anyway, Ron and I were talking about the details of the vignettes, and we, of course, also started talking about the larger issue of the role of intuitions in philosophy. So it was really sort of talking with Ron, who was a budding experimental philosopher at the time, talking with him about the role of intuitions in philosophy that got me started on this stuff around 2002, 2001, somewhere around there. But actually the conversation about the role of intuitions in philosophy started even a bit earlier because, as I said, I went to Rutgers for graduate school, and Steve Stitch was teaching there, and he passed me a draft of a review that he co-authored with another student of his, Jonathan Weinberg, who's a central figure in experimental philosophy. And this was a review of Frank Jackson's book, From Metaphysics to Ethics. I think that's not From Ethics to Metaphysics. No, it's From Metaphysics. It's From Metaphysics to Ethics. And in that, there's some sort of X-Fi tinges in that review to which I reacted negatively. So I had some, you know, conversations with Jonathan and Steve Stitch. I said, I don't think you're on the right track here. And so it was sort of in graduate school, I began to get interested, and then talking with Ron about this, about the work that eventually went into this paper, Semantics Cross-Cultural Style. That was how I started thinking about experimental philosophy and methodological issues more generally.
Well, great. So let's dive into the book, because this is a very nice segue. I usually start these interviews with asking people sort of about philosophical methodology, but since this book is all entirely about those issues, maybe one place to begin, which is part of where the book begins, is to sort of pick up on what you were just saying. Can you I'm sure most of our listeners have some sense of what experimental philosophy is, but maybe not as full a picture as it might be helpful to have. And can you spell out a little bit about the movement and what difference you see that there are different strands within the community of X-Files, and you even draw a distinction between the negative and the positive programs. Can you tell us, sort of lay out some of that territory for us?
Yeah, sure. But maybe I can say first, if you don't mind, just to preface that, what I think sure. The kind of main issue to be. So in your introduction to the book, you said, maybe a good way of describing my conclusion is to say that experimental philosophy rests on a mistake. And I think that that's right, although I think that it's really only one of these branches of experimental philosophy that you describe that rests on that mistake, and that's the negative branch. And the mistake, by the way, is just to think that intuitions are appealed to or treated as evidence for philosophical conclusions. So the book is basically an extended argument for that conclusion. No, that's not right. Philosophers don't, with any regularity, treat intuitions as evidence for philosophical conclusions. And the negative program of experimental philosophy, I think, depends on assuming that philosophers do indeed treat intuitions as evidence. The positive program, it's unclear. Now, the question about divisions, it's a bit of a dangerous question for me, because I think X-Files might, think that I'll map this territory out inaccurately. So let me just apologize to them in advance. But basically the idea, so the negative program of experimental philosophy is that program that seeks to challenge more traditional philosophical argumentation or conclusions by by gathering data about people's intuitions and noting that in many cases these intuitions pattern in a troubling way. And so when they find that, when they find these troubling patterns of intuitions, they then say, aha, this shows us that the argument that was based on this intuition is suspect. Now, what reaction the rest of us are meant to have to these studies is somewhat unclear. What I say in the book is that I think that many negative X-Files, that's the terminology I'll use. I think many negative X-Files think that once we find these troubling patterns of intuitions, we can then say that we ought to suspend judgment on some crucial claim involved in some more traditional argument. And so that's the way I think that the negative program tends to function. Now, the positive X-Files are more positive. They're a less pessimistic bunch. What they seek to do is just determine which intuitions people have, right? You might be reading a paper in philosophy, and the philosopher claims that some proposition is intuitive, and positive experimental philosophers seek to test claims like that. Is this really intuitive? It seems like an empirical question. What we ought to do is figure out whether whether people as a whole or certain groups of people in fact have that intuition, and they don't tend to use their results to challenge traditional arguments. In fact, sometimes they're seen as just empirically supporting some or another more traditional philosophical argument or conclusion. So that's the sort of positive. Was that clear enough, Bob?
Yeah, completely. So let me just ask you a very quick sort of question. So is the concern among, let's say, just now specifically talking about the negative X-Files?
Right.
Would it be right to say that here's a garden variety thought of the negative that drives negative experimental philosophy? It says something like this. Analytic philosophy seems to proceed as if the intuitions of philosophers or certain groups of philosophers or the certain philosopher who happens to be composing an article. It treats the intuitions of philosophers as if they were evidence for some philosophical conclusion. Mm-hmm. But we can show empirically that the intuitions of philosophers are not widely shared, might be peculiar to certain groups of philosophers, might reveal more about the biases of privileged academics in particular parts of the world and institutional settings, and that when you in fact go and ask the proverbial people on the street about some of the claims that philosophers seem to grant as just intuitively the case, you find that it's more common that people don't share the philosopher's intuitions. And if that's true, and if these intuitions are taken by analytic philosophers to play an evidentiary role, then it looks as if there's some deep rot at the core of analytic philosophy, because one of its main sources or alleged sources of evidence, mm-hmm. the philosopher's intuition, mm-hmm. can't play that. Yeah, doesn't have any evidentiary value at all because the intuitions are not widely shared and can be explained in all kinds of ways that lead you to think they're not reliable guides to the truth. Is that how it might run?
Yeah. I mean, I think, some people often say, I couldn't have said it better myself, and they don't mean it sincerely. But in this case, I couldn't have said it better myself. Although I think there's one thing, though, one detail I think that is maybe not quite right. So, yes, it's true that, sometimes experimental philosophers are interested in showing that a certain intuition is not widely shared. But more often, at least in the negative program, what you find is the demonstration that these intuitions, so earlier I put it, the intuitions pattern in troubling ways. And so what I mean by that is that they pattern in ways that show that we shouldn't I treat the intuition as evidence. So let's take just to put some meat on the bones of this rather abstract characterization of what's what the negative X-file critique, as I call it in the book, is up to put some flesh on the bones of that. One of the papers that I mentioned earlier, this paper, Semantics Cross-Cultural Style, seemed to show that a certain intuition in the philosophy of language varies with respect to culture, right? So Western subject groups tended to have a certain intuition, and East Asian, in fact, some of the East Asian subject pool was culled from Hong Kong U students. That's another connection that I have to XY. But anyway, so the study seemed to show that whether you have a certain intuition depends on whether you're of Western descent or instead of East Asian descent, and the result was fairly dramatic. It looked like there was this robust, dramatic difference between East Asians and Westerners with respect to the intuition. Let's just call it the intuition, the P. We can get into the details of the case later. Let's just call it the intuition, the P. Okay, so there's this cross-cultural difference in the intuition, the P. But then, as I think X-Files rightly point out, that spells trouble because whether you're of Western descent or instead of East Asian descent matters not at all to the truth of the intuition, right? So it doesn't matter whether you're East Asian, whether it's true that P relative to the case in question. So if you can show that the intuitions vary along this dimension that's not relevant to the truth of the intuition, then negative X-Files think you can show that the intuition ought not be trusted, or we should suspend judgment with respect to the judgment that the. So that's the idea that they have. So it's not just a matter of showing that this or that intuition isn't widely shared. It's also a matter, at least in many cases, of showing that the intuitions vary, as I describe it in the book, along truth irrelevant dimensions, right? Dimensions that are not relevant to the truth of the intuitions. And there are many different X-Y studies that appear to show this with respect to a variety of demographics. So, I mean, culture is just one. So they've gotten this kind of truth irrelevant variability in cases where they present sort of groups of thought experiments to subjects ordered in different ways. So there are order effects when it comes to intuitions. Some people claim that there are gender effects, effects due to socioeconomic status, and so on and so forth. And it looks like none of those things, right, whether you're a man or a woman, right, that's not going to matter to whether, say, an agent in a Gettier case knows or fails to know the relevant proposition. So it's that kind of truth irrelevant variability that I think is crucial to the negative X-file critique.
Great. So let's just get one more fact on the table before we sort of launch into the central argument of the book. So we've been talking a lot about intuitions, and you just mentioned thought experiment. And before we get into talking about the particular sort of thought experiment or intuitions that are sort of the two central cases that you discuss in the book, one is a Gettier kind of case, and the other is a famous example used by Kripke. Can you tell us a little bit just about what you mean by intuition, or what exactly we're talking about when we say, X-Files think, analytic philosophers think that intuitions are evidence? Mm-hmm. What do we mean by intuition there?
Yeah, so there's a way in which I think that's a bad question.
Okay, that's good.
I don't mean any offense by that, but this is, so sometimes when I give talks on this subject matter, that in the Q&A, that the first question is, well, you've been going on and on about intuitions, but what the heck? what are intuitions anyway? And the reason I think it's not an especially good question, I mean, I think it's an interesting question. I think that there's progress being made on it, actually. So I think that, these people who are interested in intellectual seemings, right, they have a kind of nice beginning to be fully worked out theory of what an intuition might be. It's a certain kind of intellectual seeming. So it's not a judgment or a belief. It's some other kind of propositional attitude. So I'm thinking here of people like Michael Humer and John Bengtson, and maybe earlier on, George Beeler. So I think this is kind of an interesting conception of intuitions, and I think there's, you know, interesting things to be said about the nature of intuitions. You know, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions on being an intuition? I mean, that's a decent question, I think, in analytic philosophy. But the reason I think it's a bad question, given my aims, is that I think it doesn't have to be answered in order to pursue the questions that I want to pursue. And the reason I think that is that I think that there are these clear examples of judgments that are meant to be either themselves intuitions or based on intuitions. And so we can just point to the paradigms. So you mentioned the Gettier example, and you mentioned Kripke. Well, so Kripke has this famous case in his book, Naming Necessity, the Gödel case. And he makes a certain judgment about the Gödel case. He says, well, in the story that I've just told, right, the name Gödel refers to the guy who stole the proof. I'm assuming that some of your listeners know some of the details of this of this case, right? And not to the proof's discoverer, the proof of the incompleteness of arithmetic, right? So he makes that judgment, and we can just say, look, this is an example of the kind of thing that experimental philosophers and those that are opposed to experimental philosophy have in mind when speaking of intuitions. So we have these clear examples, and not only that, we have a way of sort of drawing them together, of saying why they're examples of this troublesome thing, intuition. And so there's a kind of commonality between these kinds of judgments. And that commonality, I think, is just, well, they're judgments that philosophers make about thought experimental scenarios or hypothetical cases. And their judgments to the effect that some philosophically significant property either is or isn't instantiated, be it knowledge or referring to Gödel and not Schmidt or what have you. So as I say in the book, I think what we ought to do when pursuing these questions about the role of intuitions in philosophical method, and in particular their evidential role, what we ought to do is adopt what I call the no theory theory of intuition. So we should say only enough about intuition so that we get a grip on our subject matter and no more. And part of the reason for that is that, you know, conceptual analysis is hard, right? It's difficult to conceptually analyze anything. I mean, if there's anything that we've learned from the history of the problem of the analysis of knowledge, conceptual analysis is tough, right? And there's no reason to expect that the conceptual analysis of intuition is going to be any easier. So, hey, good news if we can proceed with these questions about the role of intuitions in philosophy without bothering to engage in this difficult conceptual analysis of intuition. So that's my idea about that question, the what is an intuition question.
Well, perfect. So, and that makes good sense. But let's just skip one other sort of central sort of ingredient in this is like a lot of philosophical concepts, intuition does admit of a kind of ambiguity that you point to, that the term can name a state, a psychological state, but also can name, it's like belief, right? There's the state sense and the content sense. So can you just sort of spell out that kind of distinction for us, and then we'll get on to look at the central argument.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for noting that, because I think that is an important aspect of at least the first chunk of the book, you know, chapters 1 and 2, this distinction between the state and content use of the term intuition. So as you say, there is this ambiguity in the term. And I think maybe the clearest way to bring it out is to think about the phrase, the intuition that P, where P just stands in for some proposition or other. So if you think about that phrase, the intuition, the P, one might use that phrase to refer to the psychological state of intuiting that P. And you mentioned belief. It's like belief in that way. So if you think of the phrase, the belief that P, you might use that phrase to pick out the state, the psychological state of believing that P. But you might also use the phrase, either one, the intuition that P or the belief that P. You might also use those phrases more simply to refer to the proposition P itself. So one of the examples that I use in the book is, you know, if you say, the belief that there is life on Mars is likely true. It looks like there you're not talking about the psychological state, you're just talking about the content, right, that there's life on Mars, right? So there's these two ways of using these phrases, the intuition that P, the belief that P, judgment also, the term judgment also admits of the same kind of ambiguity. And this ambiguity, it's rarely commented on. It's noted by Bill Lycan in a book from 1988, but he doesn't say much about its metaphilosophical significance. The way he draws the distinction, he says there are these two ways of thinking about intuitions. You can think about the intuitings, right? The state of it, the psychological state of intuiting that P, or the intuiteds, right? Which is just P itself. Jonathan Ichikawa is another author who mentions this important ambiguity and uses it, I think, to great effect in his work in metaphilosophy. So I urge your listeners to check out Jonathan's work on these topics. But the reason why it's important to me is that I think that it has a way of I think it counts as one of the fact that there is this ambiguity in the phrase the intuition of the that has that plays a large part in explaining why philosophers think that it's almost uncontroversial to say that philosophy depends heavily on intuitions. So I think that the reason that they think that it's almost uncontroversial that philosophy depends heavily on intuitions is that they're thinking about intuitions in the content sense. And I think that that's perfectly okay, right? So I think that saying that intuitions are evidence, if you have the content sense of intuition in mind, that's perfectly okay. And what I mean by okay is that's true. So it is true that the contents of what some people would be happy to describe as intuitions are treated as evidence in philosophy. After all, many people who read Gettier's short paper, in which Gettier seems to many of us to refute the JTB theory of knowledge, many people have described their reactions to the cases that Gettier describes in that paper as intuitive, right? It's intuitive that the guy doesn't know, like the Smith character in Gettier's cases. It's intuitive that Smith doesn't know. And that's fine. So okay, let them talk that way, just so long as we keep it very clear that Gettier is not saying that the fact that I am experiencing this psychological state, right, is evidence for the claims that I'm making. It's rather that the content of the intuition is used as evidence against this more general theory, the JTB theory.
And would it be right to say then that just now deploying the distinction between the state and the content sense of intuition, that you argue that the negative X-file critique depends upon the claim that analytic philosophy treats intuition in the state sense of that term as having evidentiary value.
Yeah.
And that's the thing you want to reject, right?
That's the thing I want to reject. Yeah, that's right. So the idea is that, yes, this negative X-file critique exactly depends on the claim that, or involves the claim that philosophers treat intuitions in the state sense as evidence, and in fact treats intuitions in the state sense as evidence for the contents of those very intuitions, right? So their idea is that philosophers treat the intuiting that P as evidence for the truth of P, and I claim that philosophers in fact never do that.
Well, right, and when you put it that way, it would be kind of amazing if they did. I mean, amazing in a bad way.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing I want to make clear though, that I don't accuse negative X files of claiming that, for example, it shows up as a premise in some more traditional argument. So Gettier has this argument against the JTB theory in his 1963 paper, I don't think that Negative X-Files think that it's a premise in that argument. I, Gettier, am experiencing the intuition that my Smith character doesn't know, right? It's not that. It's rather that they think that philosophers think of these intuitions in the state sense as the sort of source of the evidence. But it doesn't show up as an explicit premise in these arguments, and Negative X-Files don't think so. And of course, if you read the paper, right, you don't find mention of intuitions anywhere in the paper, and so of course you don't find a premise that says I get here, I'm experiencing this intuition that B, therefore B, right?
Right, right. So can we just talk that sort of we've been mentioning the Gettier case and this Kripke case about Gödel.
Sure.
So the book treats as sort of paradigmatic instances of analytic philosophical method the 10 coins case from Gettier and this Gödel Schmidt case from Kripke. These are, there's a reason why these are so centrally running through the book. These are common targets, or maybe principal targets, or principal cases in point of the Negative X-File critique.
Yeah.
Maybe you could just sort of remind us of what these two cases are, and then we could talk about why you think that, as you just said, these aren't appeals to intuitions in any illicit sense.
Right. Sure. So, I think it's important. Let's start with the Gettier case. So as I'm sure listeners will remember, there are actually two thought experiments, or two cases. Let's just call them cases. The two cases in Gettier's paper where he attacks the JTB theory of knowledge. One of them I call in the book the 10 coins case, and the other is the Brown in Barcelona, what I'll call the Brown in Barcelona case. And so listeners, I'm sure, remember at least roughly the details of these cases, but one of the things that I want to emphasize in the book is that it's very important to pay close attention to the way that the inventors or originators of these cases present them, right? Because if we want an accurate picture of philosophical practice as it actually is, we need to pay close attention to the original presentations. So by way of reminding listeners what the 10 coins case is, I think I'll just read out, I mean, Gettier's paper is very, very short, so I think I'll just read Gettier's own presentation of the 10 coins case, and maybe I'll take less time and just describe in my own words Kripke's Gödel case. How does that sound,
great.
Bob?
That sounds great.
Okay.
Great.
So when Gettier presents the 10 coins case, he introduces it by saying, suppose, so he says the following. So this is now just quoting from Gettier. Suppose that Smith and Jones have applied for a certain job, and suppose that Smith has strong evidence for the following conjunctive proposition. Proposition Gettier labels D. Jones is the man who will get the job, and Jones has 10 coins in his pocket. Gettier goes on. Smith's evidence for D might be that the president of the company assured him that Jones would in the end be selected, and that he, Smith, had counted the coins in Jones' pocket 10 minutes ago. Proposition D entails proposition E, the man who will get the job has 10 coins in his pocket. Let us suppose that Smith sees the entailment from D to E and accepts E on the grounds of D, for which he has strong evidence. In this case, Smith is clearly justified in believing that E is true. And now, what to me is the crucial bit, but imagine further that, unknown to Smith, he himself, not Jones, will get the job. And also, unknown to Smith, he himself has 10 coins in his pocket. Proposition E is then true, though proposition D, from which Smith inferred E, is false. In our example, then, all of the following are true. First, E is true, right? So the man who get the job has 10 coins in his pocket. That's true. Smith believes that E is true. Smith believes that the man who will get the job has 10 coins in his pocket. And three, Smith is justified in believing that E is true. But it is equally clear, Gettier goes on, that Smith does not know that E is true. For E is true in virtue of the number of coins in Smith's pocket, while Smith does not know how many coins are in Smith's pocket, and bases his belief in E on account of the coins in Jones' pocket, whom he falsely believes to be the man who will get the job. So there's the ten coins case, one of the two cases that Getty intended to use to show that the JTB theory of knowledge is not true.
And how uncommonly elegant is it? It was very nice to listen to you read that.
not many people will, you know, find the analytic philosophy that thrilling, but I'm glad that you enjoyed that.
And so how does the Kripke case run then?
Right, so the Kripke case, just to be briefer, so Kripke imagines, so as we all know, as a matter of historical fact, Gödel discovered the incompleteness of arithmetic, but Kripke tells a little story, a little fiction, in which Gödel discover the proof of incompleteness. Instead, a man that Kripke calls Schmidt discovered the proof instead, and then Gödel stole the proof from Schmidt and published it under his own name. And then Kripke asks, okay, so the case in this case is supposed to be in the service of rejecting a certain theory of reference, the descriptivist theory of reference, which roughly says that a proper name refers to that object that's denoted by the definite descriptions that users of the name have in mind when they use the name. And so Kripke's sketch of this case is meant to show, well, here's an example where the people in the story who use the name Gödel, they associate a certain description with it, namely the man who proved incompleteness. But that description picks out this other guy, Schmidt. And so now the question is, well, who does the name Gödel refer to in the story? And Kripke argues, I say, he doesn't merely record his intuition, but he argues that the name refers to the man who stole the proof and not the proof's discoverer, Schmidt. So that's the Gödel case.
And so the negative X files then,
yeah,
have shown that there's some variation in what conclusion people will draw from these cases. So there's some reason to think that some people think in the 10 coins case that Smith does know. Mm-hmm. And there's some reason to think in the Kripke case, mm-hmm, that no, users of the name Gödel are actually referring to Schmidt. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Although I should mention that experimental philosophers, in neither case really, did experimental philosophers test the actual vignettes that Getty and Kripke authored, right? So they modified them in certain ways. And in fact, the Getty case that shows up in what I think of as really the sort of first paper in experimental philosophy, that's a paper by Jonathan Weinberg, Sean Nichols, and Steve Stitch called, Intuitions in Epistemic Normativity or something like that. Sorry, I don't have the title of the paper. They tested Gettier cases, but they didn't test the 10 coins case specifically. So they tested a sort of variant. I mean, we're all, I think, familiar with the idea that there's this sort of general format to Gettier cases. And so they used a different version. But what they found, what Weinberg, Nichols, and Stitch found in the Gettier case that they tested, was that there was, they claim, cross-cultural differences in the Gettier intuition. So East Asian. So both of these early papers compared Western and East Asian subject groups, and both claim to have found significant differences in the intuitions about the cases. Right. So East Asians tended to have descriptivist as opposed to, let's call them, Kripkean intuitions about the Gödel case or a variant of the Gödel case. And East Asians tended to judge or intuit that the agent in the Gettier case really did know the proposition in question, right? Whereas Westerners tended to judge that the agent in the Gettier case really did not know the proposition in question. So here we have an example of this kind of truth irrelevant variability in intuitions with respect to what are, as you say, very central cases in analytic philosophy, one from epistemology, one from the philosophy of language.
Okay, and so your argument then, the central argument of the book, then, is that these results, the X-Fi results, pose no challenge to the philosophical positions that they're targeted against, because in fact, in these cases, not only the Kripke and the Gettier cases, but a large swath of other famous cases, what the authors of those cases are doing is actually arguing for a conclusion rather than merely appealing to the state of intuitiveness.
Yeah, that's right. So I think
that, so can you tell us a bit about how that works?
Yeah. So I think that this is a sort of common misconception. It's shared not just by experimental philosophers, X-Files, but also by a fairly large swath of how to describe them, more traditional analytic philosophers, to the effect that when you get the presentation of these cases, like the Gödel case or the Ten Coins case, what you get is just the recording of an intuition about the case. But in fact, if you look closely at the original text, what you see instead is argumentation, right? So both Gettier and Kripke, I think, clearly offer arguments. Now, nobody is going to deny that Kripke and Gettier offer arguments. So that's not right. So it's not as though, right, naming necessity is just the recording of one intuition after the other, right? Nobody thinks that there's no argument against the JTB theory in the in Gettier's 1963 paper, right? So the dispute between me and X-Files isn't whether there's an argument in these texts. We both agree that there is an argument, but where we differ is, I think that there's argument, that is, that there's argumentative support given for the judgments about the hypothetical scenarios themselves, right? And the experimental philosophers think that no, when we pinpoint that area, right, what we find instead is just this appeal to intuition, right? So it's just intuition that either is or is the source of evidence for the claim that the agent in the Gettier case doesn't know, or that the agent in the Gödel case refers to Gödel and not Schmidt, and there's no argument given for those crucial judgments about the hypothetical cases themselves. And I think that if you look closely, what we find is arguments, not intuitions, as I like to put it. That's the slogan: arguments, not intuitions. Mm-hmm. I think that slogan, it applies to those places where you might most expect to find an appeal to intuition, namely with respect to judgments about the hypothetical cases or thought experiments themselves. Yeah.
And that demonstration runs mainly by way of what I found a particularly illuminating discussion on your part of just going back to the actual texts in question. And just showing that, this place where you're supposed to just get a raw appeal to the state of being intuitive, you actually see Kripke actually giving reasons why the name doesn't fail to refer to Gödel in this instance, right?
Yeah, no, exactly. Right. I mean, I think Kripke is an especially interesting case because it's Naming a Necessity is widely regarded as a book that, involves rampant and regular appeal to intuition in support of judgments about hypothetical cases. And I think that that's just a wildly inaccurate estimation of the book. In fact, there is a long, multifaceted interesting and I think very compelling argument for the well, let's call it the Godel judgment, right? The judgment about the Godel case in Naming Necessity. It appears not just in the main text, but there's, you know, subsidiary arguments in the footnotes, and so I think, yeah, that's an unfair characterization of the way that Kripke meant to establish the truth of anti-descriptivism.
Good.
So let me just sort of consider or ask you to run us through one of the likely rejoinders to this point of the argument. So one of the things that you consider is a negative X-file rejoinder that you call the relocation sort of worry,
right.
Which I take it is just the negative X-file now gets to say, well, okay, you've shown that, you know, there's more argument in the neighborhood of the Smith case and the Godel case in Kripke. But at some point there is an appeal simply to the state of intuitiveness, that's somehow the fuel that gets the car going, as it were,
right.
even if there's eventually arguments given. Can you tell us a little bit about why you don't find that compelling?
Yeah. So I think that's a tough problem. I mean, it comes up at a couple of different points in the book. So I call it the relocation problem. And maybe, I mean, you've done a great job of explaining what I take the problem to be, but maybe I'll try to say in my own words, you know, what this problem is supposed to be. So this is, I take this to be a problem for my view of philosophical method, right? So I say, well, you know, it's definitely part of the methodology of analytic philosophy to make appeals to thought experiments and hypothetical cases. And I say that the judgments that philosophers make about these cases are backed up by argument, right? But arguments have premises, right? Or usually, right? Arguments have premises. And so then there's a question, okay, well, if philosophers don't treat intuitions as evidence for the judgments that I'm calling the judgments about the hypothetical cases themselves, there's a question about what they treat as evidence or what justifies their belief in the truth of the premises of these arguments for the judgments about the hypothetical cases. And so it can look to a reader of the book, I think, as though all that I've done is I've managed to just move the X-Fi challenge sort of back a step, right? So no, intuitions are not appealed to at this place, right? But if we move one inferential step, I don't know, is it back or forward? One inferential step back, right? Intuitions are just going to pop up again, right? It's kind of like, it's like one of those whack-a-mole, whack-a-mole sorts of problems, right? You push the problem down in one area and it pops up in a different area. And so I think that's, you know, a serious and interesting problem. I think, so, I mean, I guess a couple of different things that I can say in reply. And one is that, well, this challenge, the challenge that experimental philosophy is meant to raise against more traditional philosophy, the challenge is an empirical challenge, right? So it depends on actual empirical results that, and by the way, I think the results are very interesting. So here's an interesting fact about, you know, the psychology of philosophy. East Asians tend not to have the intuitions that Westerners do, at least in some cases, right? That's an interesting fact, and I appreciate that X-Files have you know, put that on the table. But anyway, getting back to the relocation problem, the challenge, the negative X-Fi challenge, is supposed to be an empirical challenge. It's supposed to depend on actual empirical results. And we don't have any empirical evidence of any kind that there's any reason to think that we'll find truth irrelevant variability with respect to the premises of these arguments that I say are meant to back up the claims that philosophers typically make about thought experiments and hypothetical cases. So the relocation problem, to the extent that it's something that would be put forward by an experimental philosopher, I think it's unmotivated, right? The original motivation was this empirical data. Look, we've got this variability in these intuitions. right? And then I come along and I say, but wait a minute, it isn't intuitions. The philosophers that you're targeting, they argue for these claims. If they then say, oh, but what justifies the premises? Well, that's a fair question, but it's no longer, you know, supported or backed up by real empirical data any longer, right? So that's I think one important point to make about the relocation problem as it pertains to the negative X-Phi critique.
But yeah, let me break it. At that point, it seems like the negative X-Phi challenge really just is a special version of more garden variety regress challenges.
Yeah.
Right. It just looks like, oh, this is just, you know, a regress problem for epistemic justification, or this is just a infinite regress worry that's looming.
Yeah.
But it's not distinctive of anything that X-Phi is, you know, it's not distinctive to X-Phi to raise this.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, absolutely. Again, I couldn't have said it better myself. And the only thing that I would add there is that, yes, it then looks like it turns into this, this regress worry or the problem of, inferential justification. And I mean, I think that's a problem. It's a problem that's been around for a long time. And it's unclear, how it should be solved or if it can be solved. But one thing that I think is very important to note about that problem, the problem of the regressive reasons, let's just call it that, is that it's a very general problem. So it's not a problem that applies to philosophy only, right? It applies to every domain of inquiry. And I think that sort of blunts the whatever remaining – once you notice that the X-Phi challenge, if it sort of makes this relocation problem move, you know, it doesn't have the empirical bite that it once had. Right, it sort of takes the oomph, any remaining oomph, out of it, because it now looks like, well, okay, so you've now you're saying, well, there's always this question that we can ask, you know, what justifies the premise of this argument, right? And if I then give you an answer, I say, oh, Q justifies the premise of the argument. You say, oh, well, what justifies Q? And then there we go, we're off to the races, right? We've got the regress problem.
But that's you're a problem. On the Agrippa, you're on the Agrippa trilemma.
Yeah, right. So this is a problem. This is a problem for inquiry. It's not a problem that's special to philosophy, and I think that's very important to note. Everybody, every inquirer faces the regress problem. And just one final point about that, and that's that there are varieties of solutions to the regress problem. So some varieties do make a place for intuitions, right? Maybe intuitions are the unjustified justifiers, you know, the things that stop the regress. But there are other ways of addressing the regress problem. You could be a coherentist, for example, right? And say that you don't really need to stop the regressive reasons. And actually, I think that when coming back now from a problem that I think of as this interesting epistemological problem, the regressive reasons problem, two questions about philosophical method. I think actually what we find in philosophy, you know, when we look at, the original texts where these arguments that we think of as very influential or important or as examples of progress in analytic philosophy, when we look there, we find not just, you know, reasons given for thinking that a particular judgment about a hypothetical case is true, but reasons for the reasons, right? And sometimes reasons for the reasons for the reasons. So I think that it's underestimated just how much kind of inferential structure one finds in typical examples of good philosophy.
Yeah. Well, right. And this part of the book I thought was extremely compelling. Extremely compelling. So one thing I wanted to make sure we get to is in addition to offering a defense of analytic philosophy and its use of intuitions and clarifying its role of the use of intuitions against this negative X-Phi critique, you also take some time to offer some criticism of other anti-X-Phi strategies.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about those maneuvers and why you think they don't succeed?
Yeah. Okay. So there So my way of replying to experimental philosophy, or at least to the negative variety of experimental philosophy, I have to admit to you and to your listeners, is not a very popular one. So hopefully the book is just out, so hopefully the book will gain some more converts. My closest ally in this regard is Herman Kaplan, who recently published a book called Philosophy Without Intuitions. And, the kind of overall theme of the two books is similar, although my book focuses much more on experimental philosophy than Herman's does. And Timothy Williamson has said some things similar to the kinds of things that that I say. But so far as I can tell, that it's really just, I mean, maybe, Bob, I'm glad that you've been convinced by some of the things that you've read. But I think that at this point, it's very much a minority position. But also what's not a minority position is a kind of negative reaction to negative experimental philosophy. And so one of the interesting questions is, well, how do most people think we ought to react to, most people who think that there's nothing wrong with traditional methodology in philosophy, how do they think we should respond or reply to this challenge, the challenge of negative experimental philosophy? And there are, I think, at least two discernible ways. One way is the what I call the, and what other people call the expertise defense, or the expertise reply to the negative XY challenge, and the other is what I call the multiple concepts reply to the negative XY challenge. Where should I start? I should start, I guess, with the former.
Sure.
Right. So the expertise defense says, well, the problem with experimental philosophy is really that experimental philosophers have been experimenting on the wrong subjects. This is how I like to think of the expertise defense anyway. So typical examples of experimental philosophy recruit subjects from undergraduates at universities, right? But according to the proponent of the expertise defense, this is a bad subject to test. We ought to be testing, those people who know something about philosophy. Surely they are going to have better philosophical intuitions than your average university undergraduate who might not have any background and sometimes is explicitly, selected for not having any philosophical background whatsoever. And so the expertise defense says, what matters are the intuitions of the experts. We shouldn't trust the intuitions of the untutored and the uninitiated. You've read the book, Bob, so you know what I'm going to say, but I think listeners can sort of predict what I'll say about the expertise defense. I mean, I think that the expertise defense makes the very same mistake that the proponents of the XY critique make, and that's thinking that intuitions in the state sense qualify as evidence in philosophy. It's just that the proponents of the expertise defense say it's the intuitions of a particular group of people that matter, right? Namely the philosophers,
right?
And so I think that this to make a not a very long story, but a somewhat long story, somewhat shorter, I'll just say that's basically the reason I reject the expertise reply. I think that it just makes the very same mistaken assumption that the critique that it's attempting to reply to makes.
Right.
And I guess one thing that I could add is that, I don't think that they've done a very good job. I mean, I think that properly conceived, the expertise reply is an empirical challenge to the empirical challenge that's been mounted against analytic philosophy, right? So it's supposed to be an empirical reply, but I don't think that the proponents of the expertise defense have made good on the defense, because they haven't gone out and done surveys of the experts. I mean, you would think, if you're going to say, look, it's the experts' intuitions that matter here, stop surveying undergraduates. You would think if someone were to say that, they would then, you know, get out of their armchair and start asking, you know, show up at the APA with a bunch of surveys in their hands.
Who knows what they would find?
but they haven't done that. And in fact, I mean, experimental philosophers have very graciously started doing this for them, and initial results don't look so good. That is, it looks as though, you know, very similar biases and effects that show up in the intuitions of the hoi polloi show up in the intuitions of the experts too. And if you look at the book, there's some references to experimental work that seems to suggest that that's the case. So the expertise defense, I think, is a very weak defense against, you know, what would be, except for the adherence to this myth, the myth of the intuitive, what would be an interesting and powerful. I mean, after all, the philosophy did depend on intuitions in the way that experimental philosophers think that it does. Then I think analytic philosophy would be in real trouble. And I guess that's why I think that the expertise defense is no good. It sort of misgauges the depth of the challenge that's been posed by Stitch and his students.
Right.
Yeah.
So what about the different concepts?
Yeah. The multiple concepts reply.
Right.
So the multiple concepts reply is the reply that runs something something like this, and to have some names, I guess. So I've found examples of the multiple concepts reply. So the multiple concepts reply seems to be a fairly popular reply among fairly famous and influential philosophers. So, for example, Bill Lichen, who I mentioned earlier, makes something like the multiple concepts reply to some of the XFI data and the arguments based on that data, the challenge based on that data. So does Ernie Souza, and also Frank Jackson is on paper endorsing something like this multiple concepts reply. And the multiple concepts reply is just that, well, look, in these cases where you say, you, the experimental philosopher, say that you've found, for example, cross-cultural variability in Gettier intuitions. In those examples where you say you found cross-cultural variability in Gettier intuitions, it could be that instead what you found is a group of people who have a slightly different conception of knowledge than we, you know, Western analytic philosophers have. So maybe when East Asians respond differently to the vignettes that experimental philosophers hand to them, right, they're getting it right about their East Asian concept of knowledge, whereas we Westerners are getting it right about our Western concept of knowledge. And really all the results suggest or show is that different groups of people can have different concepts of these important philosophical phenomena, like moral responsibility or reference or knowledge or what have you. Yeah. So that's the idea. The idea is that, you know, the results that experimental philosophers have gathered show at best that, you know, people are, I don't know, that the respondents are speaking a slightly different language than we're speaking when we talk about, say, knowledge, right? That's how Lichen puts it, actually. He says maybe East Asians who respond in the way that they do to the Gettier cases, maybe they're English-speaking East Asian respondents, by the way. Maybe they're speaking a different dialect of English than the dialect that we're speaking. So that's the form of the reply. And let's see. So I make two complaints about the multiple concepts reply in the book, and the first is just that again, it looks as though the multiple concepts reply makes the same mistake that the expertise reply makes and that the negative X file critique makes. That is, the multiple concepts reply seems to assume that intuitions in the state sense are treated as evidence in first order philosophy, and so I think that's a serious mark against the multiple concepts reply. But I also think that they don't have good enough grounds for claiming these different groups of subjects are applying different concepts. And so what I say is that, the idea that when, I assert P and you, Bob, deny P, we ought to just take it as a default that we are genuinely disagreeing with one another. Of course, it could be that we're understanding the words that we're using slightly differently, and so we're not genuinely disagreeing, we're having what's sometimes called a merely verbal dispute. That's a possibility. But the default should be Bob and I genuinely disagree over P, right? And the proponents of the multiple concepts reply, I think, just they do nothing to argue for the conclusion that we ought to think that this default justification that we have for believing that when people seem to disagree, they actually are disagreeing, should be overridden in the cases that experimental philosophers are interested in. And I think at least in some of the cases of these proponents of the multiple concepts reply, I think that a kind of skepticism about the possibility of knowing that there's that we have a genuine disagreement on our hands is looming, right? Because if what you say in response to these X-Fi results is, oh, well, hey, look, it's possible that we're merely verbally disagreeing with this other group of people. Well, that possibility is a possibility that applies to you and I, right? So
that's right.
So the consideration seems to suggest that you and I don't know whether we're genuinely agreeing or disagreeing. And so I think that the multiple concepts reply engenders a kind of skepticism that's even more severe than the kind of skepticism that you would get from the negative X-file critique.
Well, great. So you've been very generous with your time. So let me ask one final question before I let you go. Do you think that there are any prospects for the kind of positive work that X-Files do? Is there any place in philosophy for, or any promise for philosophy to leaving aside the critique of analytic philosophy that seems to fuel a lot of X-Fi work, and just focusing on the actual positive work that they do, is there any promise to some of the work that gets done there on the positive side?
Yes. Thanks for asking that question, because I think this is an important part of the book. And I think that, if you look at the back cover, the blurbs on the back cover, you'll come away with the sense that the book is just an extended attack on experimental philosophy. And to some extent, it is an attack on experimental philosophy. I don't deny that. But I do think that it's important to emphasize the positive features of experimental philosophy. And by positive features, I don't mean to be speaking of the positive program in experimental philosophy. So I don't mean to say that it's the positive program that's particularly fruitful or worthwhile or anything like that. I just mean that X-Fi in general is a phenomenon, in all of its branches, has done some positive, has done some good for philosophy. After all, I mean, my interest in methodological issues, as I said early on in the interview, was inspired by conversations with experimental philosophers, and so I have them to thank for reflecting seriously on my own philosophical practice and thinking carefully about the philosophers that I admire, how they've managed to convince me of the philosophical views that I now have. And so without experimental philosophy, I'm not sure, how reflective I would have been about all of that stuff. And so I think it's great. A lot of the good work that's being done in methodology, I think, is owed, at least in its kind of impetus, right, to experimental philosophy. So I think that's an important thing to note. While bad-mouthing in the way that I've been bad-mouthing it for most of the interview. And I think also that, as you say, there's this way in which I think that the myth of the intuitive has hamstrung experimental philosophy, and it sort of keeps it away from contributing in the way that I think it can contribute most valuably. Because the kind of dominant thinking in experimental philosophy circles is that these results that you get when you go out there with your surveys, that has some bearing on philosophical theory, right? It has some bearing on, you know, what the whether this or that argument in philosophy is good or bad. It has some bearing on philosophical theory, or the evidence for has some bearing on the evidence for philosophical theory. And I think if you just put that aside, you just say, no, let's not worry about that, and let's instead just focus on this interesting distinction between, as I put it in the conclusion of the book, two ways of cognizing a judgment, right? Either arriving at that judgment after careful reflection, right, or arriving at it relatively spontaneously and non-inferentially, right? If we just focus on that distinction, I think that distinction has there's a lot of interesting work that can be done and is being done on that distinction. And I guess I think here primarily of work that's being done in moral psychology, right, and where the difference between, you know, the kind of, you know, the real-time, quick moral decision-making that you do is often very different from, you know, what you think you ought to do when considering a hypothetical scenario sitting in your armchair. So I think that distinction is extremely important, maybe perhaps especially to ethics and moral philosophy, and that experimental work has an obvious and clear relevance to it. But I think that experimental philosophers ought to just sort of put aside the idea that this experimental work on intuitions will have some bearing on philosophical theory or the evidence for philosophical theory. And I think that distinction, this distinction between two ways of cognizing and judgment, you know, let's just say inferentially or non-inferentially, I think that distinction, you know, that can crop up in other areas too, not just in ethics, but in the philosophy of language and epistemology too. And it'd be interesting to see, you know, to see what work sort of philosophers, you know, hand in hand with cognitive scientists and psychologists could do exploring that distinction. I just don't think that any of it is going to show us that, for example, Kripke was wrong about descriptivism or that Getty was wrong about the JPP theory.
Well, that's excellent. I want to thank you for sharing your time to talk about the book, The Myth of the Intuitive. Max, thank you so much.
Bob, thanks very much. I was delighted to give the interview and to have a chance to talk with you about the book. Thank you very much for the opportunity. It was a pleasure.
Well, take care now.
Okay.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Max Deutsch of the University of Hong Kong. We were talking about his new book, The Myth of the Intuitive, newly published by MIT Press. I'm Robert Talese, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thanks for listening.